This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Before I went to medical school, there were no post-baccalaureate programs, and I didn't study any science as an undergraduate, so a smart advisor told me to go get a master's degree in something with science in it as a way to get into medical school. And I ended up studying clinical nutrition. And so I got into medical school as someone with a background in nutrition, and then spent much of the rest of the early part of my career and continuing thinking about the interface between clinical nutrition and internal medicine. I started an inpatient TPN service, we called it then, a nutrition support service. And then later, as my passion became more ambulatory, our first weight management program, and it has been decades. And so I've been thinking about this topic for quite a long time. I will say I'm a slow adopter of new interventions. As you know, I'm sort of very fundamentalist when it comes to evidence, but my thinking has changed based on some of the studies I'm going to show you related to the use of GLP-1 agonists for weight. However, it's not easy, it's not straightforward, it is very nuanced, there are best practices and contexts, and I will try to touch on all of those in the next 40 minutes. I have no relevant financial relationships. I'll say a few words about what's new about diagnosis of obesity, and then we'll put in a context talking about diet and lifestyle. We'll focus primarily on medications, and just at the end, if we have time, just a word or two about surgery. So, we are stuck with the BMI. There have been efforts in the past to move past it. There are going to be efforts in the future to move past it. The body mass index was developed primarily because there's a very close linear relationship between the body mass index and total body fat. The problem is that total body fat isn't really the thing you're most worried about. You're worried mostly about visceral upper body fat, which is metabolically active. So that we have an imperfect measurement in the manner in which we diagnose obesity. There are other ways to do it. We may move there in the future, but at least for the next several years, if for no other reason, then that's how your insurance companies and pharmacy managers and Medicare and Medicaid are thinking about whether, and the FDA are thinking about approving medication. So we will, despite its flaws, continue to use the body mass index. You can use anthropometric criteria. There have been several of these that have been developed over the years. The one that's most fashionable now is waist circumference, because that gives you a little bit more sense of adiposity in the upper body. The numbers to remember are 40 inches in men and 35 inches in women. It turns out it's not that easy to measure a waist circumference reliably, especially as people get bigger. Their umbilicus moves around. You can't find the greater trochanter and so on. But nonetheless, especially in people with class 1 and class 2 obesity, that is BMIs in the 30 to 40 range, it can be a helpful adjunct. After a body mass index of 40, it's no longer necessary. Those people have a clear clinical obesity. There are more sophisticated measures of body fat, but most importantly, what we care about are clinical abnormalities. There are those people who are big, and there are those people who are big who are sick, and that's going to be one of the key themes here as we go through thinking about how to treat patients with this disorder. The BMI was developed in the early 20th century. It was developed to define, quote, ideal white men. It doesn't address a localization of adiposity. Racial groups have different risks at different BMIs. Women have different body composition. It's altered by muscle mass. And so athletes have falsely high BMIs, the frail have falsely low BMIs. So it's really an imperfect tool. So use it as a screening test and then move on to the next step. The WHO has put together, this is brand new, put together an international commission on this, just published in January of this year. It reinforces this idea. These are not new concepts, but they've done a terrific job of really articulating them. And the idea is basically that what you're looking for is clinical obesity, which is both an excess of adiposity and adiposity that can lead to health consequences. So these are people with excess body fat who are sick, and these are the people you want to treat. And then they've defined a preclinical obesity, almost like pre-diabetes, not quite analogous, which is excess adiposity, but without significant functional impairments. So they have increased risk over time, like patients with pre-diabetes, but they don't have the disease. And those are people who you would use non-pharmacological therapy, like with pre-diabetes, and close monitoring. And we'll talk more about how to manage those patients later on. But this whole idea, the take-home message is you're measuring size, and then you're measuring size with health consequences. So all those patients in your workup should get obviously carefully done blood pressures, lipids, blood sugars, and the like, looking for health consequences of their weight. So the classic BMI categories that we're stuck with are shown here. Less than 25 is normal, 25 to 30 is overweight. And then we call obesity starting at 30. And we use the language class 1, class 2, and class 3 over 40. We don't use the word morbid obesity anymore because morbidity, that is obesity-related illnesses, can occur at any weight and are not unique to body mass index over 40. So use the language obesity class 1, class 2, class 3. And I've referred to the fact throughout the week that all of our risk factors, when we look at the relationship between some bodily function, like an LDL or 1 over HDL or a blood pressure or a blood sugar, there's this gradual curvilinear relationship that defines the risk. And this is true with obesity as well. So here's body mass index, and here's health outcomes on this axis. This is all-cause mortality in this case. This is from a very large database. Women and men, women in red. And we'll just look at the women just to use as an illustration. It's the same in both, although the risk is higher in men, but the shape is the same. And a couple of observations here. Number one, there's a J shape to this curve. And the reason there's a J is because of tobacco use. So if you eliminate current and former smokers from the cohort, this flattens out. So smoking is associated with excess mortality and is associated with thinner body weights. Then you have a part of the curve where the risk is increasing. And most interesting to me is that you have an area of the curve that's pretty flat. So there is increased risk, and you can define statistical differences in large populations between 31 and 20 and 24, but it's a relatively flat part of the curve. When you get up to a body mass index of 40, the risk is about double. So it's not 4 times or 10 times the risk. But there is increased risk. So the take-home message is, if you find someone who's really thin, unless they have chronic illness or a psychiatric illness or and the like, think about cigarettes. Number two, we no longer think about ideal body weights. Rather, we think about a range of acceptable weights that's associated with good health. And three, obesity is a risk factor for early mortality. But it's not 20-fold increase, it's 2 to 4, depending on other cofactors, which I'll define. So in summary, the greater BMI is associated with an increased rate of death from all causes, which I just showed, and cardiovascular causes, but the absolute risk for an individual is modest. There are, on the other hand, there are over 200 comorbidities associated with obesity. And the take-home message clinically is that even modest weight loss, which we define as 5 to 10%, improves clinically important comorbidities, hypertension, triglycerides, liver disease, diabetes, prediabetes, PCOS, and so on. So it is worth it to get someone down 7% of their body weight. And that's what the diabetes prevention program did, and it, as a result, it prevented diabetes from progressing. So 7% is a number to remember. I'll show you why in just a moment. So this is our treatment pyramid. We focus on lifestyle modification. Meal replacement has gone out of favor. These are prepackaged meals that were effective because you can get down to about 1,000 calories a day and meet protein and micronutrient requirements. And they led to twice as much weight loss in the short term, but no difference in the long term. But they could be effective when you needed short-term weight loss, like before surgery, really bad diabetes, and so on. But the medications have replaced them. And then surgery. So just to look at the average impact, lifestyle modifications, 5 to 10%. Again, the diabetes prevention program is 7. Then I used to think meal replacement was double that, about 15. The medications also about double that, about 15. And then surgeries double that, which is about 30. So that's a really good way to think about it, that if you're using lifestyle, you can expect 5 to 10% weight loss. And it's important for patients to understand that. So if they weigh 200 pounds and they do everything just right, the expectation is they'll lose 14 pounds, not 40 pounds. And similarly with medications, if they're 300 pounds and they take a medicine successfully, they might lose 45 pounds, not 150 pounds. Now, on the other hand, remember, like everything in medicine, these are averages, and around the average is a Gaussian distribution of response. So some patients do better in each of these categories, and some patients do worse. And then, of course, there's always the issue of what happens after weight loss. So I like to think there's weight loss, and then another phenomenon completely different called weight maintenance of weight loss. And that's different, and we'll talk about that as well. So even with surgery, for example, when people lose 30% of their body weight at 1 year, at 5 years, they've gained back about a third of it, so down to about 20% body weight. So there's a tendency to gain weight back with all of our traditional therapies. We haven't seen that as much with the GLPs, although the length of follow-up has been shorter. So a few words about diets. The bottom line is calories count. There is some nuance here and different factors and so on, but the bottom line is it is all about calories. So this is the laws of thermodynamics. Basically, to lose weight, your intake needs to be less than your requirement. In general, most people need around 2,000 calories a day if they're young and healthy. Most patients who are older need about 1,800 calories a day. I'm making up numbers, but these are our averages. Bigger people might need 18, smaller people might need 14, 16. So to create an energy deficit, it gets really low because people don't need much. A pound of fat in a bomb calorimeter is worth 3,500 calories. So if you have a 500 calorie a day deficit times 7 days, that's 3,500 calories, you would lose 1 pound per week. Right. So if you only need 1,500 calories a day to break even, and you want to lose a pound a week, that's 1,000 calories a day. That's really, really hard. So that's why this is so impossible for people. Macronutrient composition is not a factor. Remember, there are only three macronutrients, carbohydrate, protein, and fat. You can also get calories from alcohol. Those are the four sources of calories in our diet. And there are gazillion studies comparing different macronutrient compositions, low carb, high protein, high fat, low fat. The bottom line is the weight loss is all the same, that it matters more about adherence and total calorie intake than macronutrients. So if you want to go on a vegan diet, a low carb diet, a healthy Atkins diet, a Weight Watchers diet, a Mediterranean diet, with healthy foods, they're all good. The key though is to make sure your calorie intake is lower than what you require. And timing of eating doesn't matter. That is, the studies that intermittent fasting would have some special characteristics is not true. It has not panned out to be successful. And in general, if you compare intermittent fasting, that is eating over, say, 7 hours at a period rather than random eating throughout the 24-hour cycle, at the same calorie intake, there's no difference. Now, there are a few patients who, when you take a history and get to know them, and you're asking them about their eating and their families and foods intake and so on, you realize that they have a problem with, say, late evening eating. And that's when they take in an extra 40% of their calories. And maybe for them, some behavioral mechanism whereby you say, let's stop eating at 7, see how that works. You can imagine how that would help. But it's helping from a behavioral standpoint, not a metabolic standpoint. So there's nothing metabolically magical about intermittent fasting. So the bottom line is you need to eat less than what you need. So we try to think about 500 calories a day less. That is equivalent of a pound a week. Eat healthy foods. There's good data that monitoring helps. Planning what you're going to do today helps. Plan today what you're going to do tomorrow helps. Keeping track of what you did today helps. And there are a variety of ways to do that with apps these days, but and more traditional methods as well. Don't drink any calories. So we've focused a lot over the years with soda pop, but there are many other drinks that are full of calories, sports drinks, waters, and so on. And of course, alcohol has the same amount of calories as Pepsi. And so just keep that in mind as you're figuring out your daily intake. The easiest thing to do in our society is to eliminate added foods with added sugars and eliminate foods with refined carbohydrates. So focus on the bad carbs, because that, no matter what diet you're talking about, whether it's vegan diets or Atkins or Stillman or Scarsdale or Weight Watchers or whatever, no one supports eating added sugar and refined carbs. So there's a common, what I would call a generic diet, where everyone wants to be off, everyone should be off those two food groups. Typically, the way I've come to think about it, is that you should define, based on who you are and your culture and background and so forth, a basket of healthy food. And from within that basket of healthy food, and by that I mean food your grandmother or maybe your great grandmother would agree was food. And then you put yourself on a budget, just like you do with money, and you create a calorie intake per day. And just like with money, if you make some bad decisions one day, you need to make better decisions the next day. So you're looking for high value purchases, you know, good healthy foods, but you still have to limit the calories. So even though you're eating healthy, healthy, healthy food, if you eat too much of it, you won't lose weight. So Michael Pollan said it as well as anyone, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. You could add fish and occasional lean meat and fowl. But eating is a good thing. We don't want to penalize patients because they need to eat less. We want to make that good and get rid of the junk, focus on portion control, and prioritize fresh, minimally processed foods. Now, typically we talk about the Mediterranean diet, there is evidence, actually a randomized trial from Europe that studied the Mediterranean diet and did show improved cardiovascular and mortality outcomes in patients on Mediterranean diet. So the Mediterranean diet is the most evidence-based of the diet type when you're looking at cardiovascular and long-term mortality. But that may not be culturally appropriate for who your patient is. So there's a wonderful website that I recommend called Old Ways Heritage Pyramids. You can Google them, and they have an African heritage diet, a Latin American diet, Asian diet, and others. And there's still the same principles as a Mediterranean diet, but with culturally appropriate food. So this is a wonderful website. And it's very easy to find. The Harvard has a wonderful Mediterranean diet pyramid and so on. But it's a little ethnocentric probably to talk about the Mediterranean diet given our patients. But the basic principles of the foods that are in a Mediterranean diet remain the same. All right, what about exercise? So the guidelines are 150 to 300 minutes of moderate intensity exercise per week. My line to patients, you can steal this, is exercise is biblical, 6 days a week and 1 day of rest. So plan today when you're gonna exercise tomorrow. Never to get rid of that idea is, am I going to exercise today? You are going to exercise today. The question is when, how, what, and so on. So just plan today what you're going to do tomorrow, given how busy you are. With patients, now young people and people training for certain things, I'm not going to criticize high intensity training, but with patients, I don't recommend it. I tell patients, I want you to focus on frequency daily and duration about 30 plus minutes a day. And if you do 30 minutes a day most days and a little bit more on the weekend or whatever, that gets you up to, 250 minutes a day. There is some evidence that 300 may be better than 150. And certainly when it comes to weight maintenance, the data is very strong that it requires an hour a day. So larger amounts of aerobics. Now that's cardio. But you really need to hold on to your muscle. Remember, the body is made up of water, fat, and muscle, and bone. And what you want to do is lose fat, but hold on to muscle and bone. And so strength training is essential for an essential part of your exercise regimen. Now, another key point is there's a very broad literature on exercise comparing exercise for weight loss, so diet alone versus diet plus exercise, very little difference. So for short-term weight loss, exercise is not additive. That's the only bad thing I'm going to say about exercise. It does all the other things you want it to do, but it is not an effective weight loss tool. And as I'll show you again at the end, it's critical for maintenance of weight loss. All right, and I'll end this section with this. This is, again, a classic study like the one Peter showed. This is one of dozens of studies now, but it really makes a key point, which is that this is a large study. This one happened to be in men, but there are equivalent studies in women, studied for a long period of time. It was an observational study, so flawed and weak in that way. But if you took people who were fit and normal weight as their reference group, and then looked at the ones that didn't exercise, that weren't fit, their excess mortality in 14 years, this mortality was double. So sedentary lifestyle is a risk factor for early mortality. We've known that for a long time. If you took people whose body mass index was over 30, most of them were not fit, they had a threefold increase in early mortality. But here's the punchline. The people whose body mass index was over 30, who were fit, had no excess mortality compared to the people who were thin and fit. So this is where the phrase fitness trumps fatness comes from, this kind of literature. And so when I see a patient now, when I see a patient for a long time, the first thing I say to them is, whether they're seeing me for weight or primary care, the first thing I say to them is I change the topic. And I say, my number one goal for you is to be as fit as you can possibly be at the weight you're at. My second goal for you is that you don't gain any more weight. And then my third goal, if you're motivated and the circumstances are right, is to lose weight. But the first goal is to be as fit as you can be at the current weight, because that prevents mortality. All right, we'll talk about medicines for the rest of our time. So as I've, my bias around medications in general is I'm a sort of a go low, start low, go slow kind of guy. I'm a slow adopter of new medicines. I like outcome trials, as you've heard. I've been a slow adopter on these medications over the years. I'm also aware of their history, and just this slide is fun for those of you who have lived through some of this. And way back when, people were using amphetamines for weight loss. The most common one was most recently still available, excuse me, is phentermine, which has cardiovascular side effects and abuse potential. In the 70s, there was fenfluramine that caused pulmonary hypertension and was taken off the market. In the 80s, sibutramine, Meridia was the trade name, increased strokes. So this was the first time that an obesity medicine was tested in a cardiovascular outcome trial. They were really hoping to win the game. They lost the game. So the medicine caused increased strokes, and the medicine was withdrawn from the market. You all remember Fen-Phen, which was a combination of fenfluramine and phentermine put together. This caused increased valvular heart disease and was pulled off the market. Orlistat, still available as a lipase inhibitor, doesn't work and causes fat malabsorption. And then lorcaserin was a serotonin agonist, and it had increased cancers, and it was withdrawn from the market. So it's sort of an inelegant history of weight loss medicines. And so my pretest probability when I heard new medicines were coming out was always a little on the skeptical side. The medicines we currently have are listed here. Qsymia is interesting. It's a combination of two older medicines, phentermine, which is an amphetamine and has been used for a long time, and topiramate, which is really a seizure medicine, but also used for other things like migraines and the like. And both of them caused some weight loss, and so they were packaged together and caused a little more. I'll show you the data in a moment. Another medicine around is called Contrave. This is also a combination medicine. Again, thinking about, given the complexity of appetite, we need to use multiple medicines to inhibit our systems in different ways. This is bupropion, trade name Wellbutrin, and naltrexone, which we use for alcohol use disorder. So this is an interesting combination, and this is one I still use. I don't order Contrave because you still have to go through a prior authorization and so on and so forth, and it's expensive. But you can use, especially if the patient's depressed, bupropion is the only weight loss medicine that's associated with weight loss rather than weight gain. It's one of my go-to antidepressants anyway. And if they have some, certainly if they have alcohol use issues or drug use issues, or and maybe even sugar addiction or binge eating, you can use naltrexone. So this combination, you can sort of do a workaround and prescribe bupropion for depression and naltrexone for something else, and recreate Contrave. The problem is it's not the most effective drug, but if you're treating depression effectively, that's important. And if maybe, and certainly if it's substance use, that's a twofer. And then we get into the GLPs. Liraglutide was the first one, and now the two big ones, Wegovy, semaglutide and tirzepatide, or trade name Wegovy and Zepbound. So just to be clear, these are the same two medicines I talked about yesterday. So these are the same two, exactly the same chemicals that we use for diabetes and for GLP-1s. However, they have different trade names. And so when you're writing prescriptions for weight loss, if you write for Ozempic for weight loss, it will not be approved because Ozempic is not approved for weight loss. Ozempic is approved for diabetes. So you must write Wegovy if it's for weight loss and Ozempic if it's for diabetes, and you must write Mounjaro if it's diabetes and Zepbound if it's weight loss. Now, not everyone practices this way, but if you look at the studies on how these drugs were effectiveness was established, all of them use concurrent lifestyle as a way as part of the study. In fact, some of the older studies, you couldn't get into the study until you had lost 5 pounds or so with lifestyle. I'll show you the data in just a moment, but most of the studies we now rely on use intensive concurrent lifestyle. Not quite as good as the diabetes prevention program, but usually the placebo group would lose 3 or 4 pounds, 3 or 4% of their body weight. And so theoretically, if you really want to be an evidence fundamentalist, you should only use these medications in conjunction with the same kind of lifestyle approach you would use otherwise. And again, the studies of medications enrolled subjects in intensive lifestyle programs. And because I want people to use concurrent lifestyle, I work on that as well as my overall assessment. I work on that on my first visit, and I'll almost never start medications on the first visit for that reason. So these are the current medicines again. Here are the comparative results. Orlistat doesn't really work. Contrave, not bad, especially in the first year. Qsymia, a little better. But remember, these are not comparisons with each other. This is medicine versus placebo, so it's a little hard to know for sure whether these drug effects are comparable. Saxenda did better, and of course, the big news is Wegovy and Zepbound, around 12 to 18% of body weight. So, for example, here's one of the big studies for semaglutide, Wegovy. This is patients without diabetes. They got a lot of counseling for diet and exercise, tracking, counseling, and so on. So it wasn't just, here's the medicine, go home. And here was the big results. And this is looking at weight at about 5, 6 years, five, no, 2 years. So the placebo group lost 2.5% of their body weight, and the experimental group lost 15%. Of course, the drug company said 15%. It's actually 12.5%, because you have to subtract the weight from the placebo group. But what's notable is the weight loss continued for a year, which is about what you'd see with bariatric surgery. And what was striking was that when the medicine was continued, the weight loss was maintained off. So there wasn't weight gain. Now, it's obviously the study stopped at 2 years, and we don't know exactly what happens at 8 years, 10 years, 12 years. But it's very striking that there's steady weight loss and then weight maintenance. Now, what happens if you stop the drug? All right, I'll take the drug, but I don't want to be on this drug forever. It doesn't work, at least on average. And so if you stop the drug, people gain about two-thirds of the body weight back. Now, we don't have that, we don't know that much about ways that there's probably a subset of individuals and a subset of techniques, and maybe in the future, a subset of medications that we can use to prevent this weight gain. But based on our current thinking, what we think is that we need to keep people on the medication for long term. Now, this sounds horrible to many patients, this concept. But if they had diabetes, they'd be on it long term. So that's not a bad frame of reference from our point of view in terms of trying to explain to people why you're beginning to think that way. But based on the current literature, that is the way you would begin to think. What about if I just take it for a short while, just a little boost to get me started? Well, that doesn't work either. You lose some weight, stop the medicine, you gain the weight back. So this is just pretty strong evidence that you need to start the medicine and keep people on it indefinitely. This was the big study. This is December 2023, so only a little over a year ago, and I won't go through all the detail, but this was a big randomized trial, and this was their big cardiovascular outcome trial, analogous to what I showed you in diabetes. And again, this was a short-term, this is a 40-week study, so these people had greater absolute risks than you'd have to multiply by three. So these are people with cardiovascular risks in the mid-20s. But the bottom line is that there was a 20% reduction in cardiovascular outcomes in patients on semaglutide. So this is basically using semaglutide like a statin. So post-MI, you can also use it for stroke and peripheral artery disease with specific criteria. So it's like using semaglutide like a statin to prevent recurrent cardiovascular disease. And just like diabetes, these people you would treat on the medicine forever. So now you have two groups of patients. If they have diabetes, you're going to treat them forever. If they have coronary artery disease or stroke, you're going to treat them forever. The middle, the data looks like we should treat them forever, but we don't have the long-term outcome data. But I explained that to patients. And then in March, just a year ago, FDA approved Wegovy to reduce the risk of cardiovascular death, heart problems, and stroke in adults with cardiovascular disease and obesity. So this is game-changing because we have a lot of patients with heart disease and neurological disease, and so now we have a new way to get people approved for this medication. All right. The next big story is tirzepatide, as I've shown different brand names depending on the condition. Also has the usual GLP mechanisms, but also has a second incretin called GIP, which increases lipolysis and fatty acid synthesis. So now you're getting even more mechanisms of action to change metabolism. And this is the big tirzepatide study. And at full dose, which is 15 milligrams a day, people lost 20% of their body weight compared to 3 for placebo. And again, this makes the point. These people were following diet and exercise because even the placebo group was losing weight. So this looks like a bigger number than we saw with semaglutide. And so the presumption is that tirzepatide causes more weight loss. I'll show you some direct experiments in a minute and comment on that. There's another really interesting thing about this slide that's often not appreciated, which is that the low dose of tirzepatide, we started 2.5 and then 5, and then 7.5, 10, 15. So it's a 5-dose escalation, same as Wegovy. But look at this. The dose response curve here is not linear. So 5 milligrams of tirzepatide was associated with a terrific weight loss. And so 3 times more got you more weight loss, but it wasn't 3 times more weight loss. So this is a really important point, that most of these studies try to push patients to the maximum dose. But in the real world, you don't have to do that because you may get really good effect at a lower dose. And that's true with semaglutide as well. That's a really important point. What happens when you stop tirzepatide? You gain the weight back. And this was the most recent study. This was published in June last year, less than a year ago, in patients with sleep apnea. Interestingly, to get into this study, you needed just an AHI hypopnea index of only 15. So this is pretty early moderate sleep apnea. Most of the patients in the study had much higher AHIs than that. But it was worth noting that the inclusion criteria was 15, and that became what the FDA used. And I'll say that again in a different manner in a second. But basically, AHI with CPAP and a separate limb without CPAP, tirzepatide versus placebo. And this is a complicated slide, but if you just look up in this corner, this is people without CPAP, you can see a dramatic reduction in the AHI with tirzepatide associated with terrific weight loss. And the same was true if you're on CPAP. So this drug treats sleep apnea. And as a result of that, as a Christmas present, the FDA approved Zepbound for the treatment of moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea in adults with obesity or overweight. And I emphasize the moderate because this is an AHI of 15, which is highly prevalent in our patient population. So this is another way to get people on these medicines. So now you have three easy ways to get people on these medicines: diabetes, coronary artery disease, and sleep apnea. The people in the middle is still tricky. What about comparing tirzepatide with semaglutide? Some evidence to suggest they're better. But in my own experience, I think because the means are different, the Gaussian distribution around the mean has enough overlap that I don't have a super strong preference as to which one I start. I think for two reasons, so for the last 2 years, I've been almost routinely starting semaglutide because I had more experience and there was more better outcome data. But two things have happened with tirzepatide in the last 6 months. One that I just showed you, which is that it treats obstructive sleep apnea. And two, Lilly has come up with a creative way of selling tirzepatide so that instead of in a separate pen, you can buy a vial and it's half the price. And so if you work with Lilly directly, if you can get your electronic health system to put it in so you can write a prescription, you can prescribe tirzepatide now. And they've increased it. First, they just did it at low doses. Now it's up to almost full dose at half the price. So more like $400 a month rather than $1,200 or $1,000 a month. on the horizon. You're probably too late for stock investing, but nonetheless, there are over 20 drugs in development, and there will be more, looking at more GLPs, more incretins, I'm sorry, more including glucagon, higher dose Rybelsus we talked about the other day, and many, many others. So, you know, this will be true for the rest of our lives, that these drugs will be coming at us fast and furious. Some medication best practices. The drugs, so many of you know who are prescribing these, you'll get a request for a second prior authorization, often at 4 months or 6 months. And that's because the FDA has approved these drugs, saying that if there's not been if there's not been weight loss, the drug is no longer approved, then you should stop it. And that makes good clinical sense anyway. If the drug's not working, why use it? But you'll also have to explain this to the drug company. So explain it to the patient too. So this is, they have a really good shot at this, and they really want to do all the right things to make it work. What are all the right things? You define a basket of food that your grandmother thought was food. You put yourself on a budget. You exercise 300 minutes a week, and you do strength training. In addition, you spread out the calories through the day. You don't eat big meals. You don't eat added sugar, and you don't eat excess fat, because those are all the things that make the side effects. So you really, so if you just give the drug and don't do anything else, they don't work. People get side effects and they don't lose weight. If you do all the right things, they're pretty amazing. And again, exercise is key, and the goal is to preserve muscle. I used to say the goal is to preserve muscle. I now say the goal is to preserve muscle and bone, because one of the health realities of people with high BMIs is they have thicker bones, they have denser bones, and they also have more muscle. And so you can't grow new muscle when you're on a low calorie diet, because you're also a negative nitrogen balance, but you can preserve muscle. And so I tell patients, the goal here is to preserve every muscle fiber you have. And the way you do that is with exercise, 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 including strength training. And you're not trying to get big, but just high rep, high frequency strength training. Ongoing questions. What other clinical conditions can be improved with GLP? This course talked about knee arthritis, but there are at least 42 others that have been mentioned. We talked about kidney disease the other day, heart failure, a MASH, you know, bad liver disease, PCOS. This is obviously going to have major, major impact, maybe substance use, depression. There's a lot of possibilities here. An unknown is there a reduction in morbidity and mortality in cardiovascular disease in patients without pre-existing CVD? So we have good outcomes data for secondary prevention. It's like statin and secondary prevention, but we know that it causes weight loss for primary prevention, but we don't know that it reduces outcomes. So this is really important data. This would really be a game changer if we were really preventing strokes and heart attacks in people without prior existing disease. And then the issues of how do we address costs and inequalities. These medicines are expensive. If everyone is on them, it's gonna bankrupt the healthcare system. If we have $800 million of Medicaid cuts, that's gonna be a problem, because Medicaid has been one of the very best payers in many states for these drugs. All right, I think because of time, I won't talk about surgery, but it's there for your look. Just a word or two about weight maintenance. Different than weight loss. Remember, so there's a study of people who have successfully kept their weight off, and they have three common factors. So this is a cohort. It's a registry, and these are people who have been followed for 10 years who have lost greater than 10% of their body weight and kept it off, and they've been able to keep it, 20% of their body weight, and they've been able to keep it off for 10 years. And the question is, what do? They do three things. They eat a low-calorie diet forever. So 1,400 calories a day would have been the weight loss dose at the beginning for many of them. Now it's a weight maintenance dose. As you get smaller, you need less. This is what I call the forever diet. The exercise data is an hour a day in this cohort rather than 30 minutes a day. And they continue to monitor their intake. So that's the principles of weight maintenance, which are slightly different than the principles of weight loss. All right, so I will stop there and just end with some things I commonly say to patients. I've already mentioned most of these, but feel free to borrow them. So my most important phrase is, my goals for you are to be as fit as possible at your current weight. Don't gain any more weight. That requires a strategy and a plan. And if you're interested, consider weight loss. Plan today what you will eat tomorrow. Plan today when you will exercise tomorrow. Exercise is biblical, 6 days a week, 1 day of rest. Focus on the frequency and duration of exercise, not the intensity. You have a calorie budget. Spend it on healthy, lower calorie foods. Don't drink any calories. Avoid almost all added sugar and almost all refined carbs. I didn't talk about it, but if you want to be more positive about the diet, talk about dietary fiber. Most people need about 30 grams a day, and most of us eat about half that. So eat more fiber. Follow Michael Pollan's principles. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Add fish. And this is the last one, is maybe more a life philosophy than a nutrition one. But if you can't make the best choice, make a better choice. So with that, I'll leave you, and thank you very much for your attention.
We'll start with an online question. Can you talk about the slew of GLP side effects?
Yeah.
Such as Ozempic face and depression, and which ones should we know about?
Most of the worst side effects are GI. So patients commonly, 44% of patients get nausea, and people use different words like, and they get reflux, they get burping, some people get emesis, some people get diarrhea unpredictably, some people get constipation, but the GI side effects are by far and away the most most common. Depression has been reported. I haven't seen very much of that. It's obviously something I think about. You can treat those patients with Wellbutrin if they're really developing true. Usually I don't like to treat a side effect with another medicine, but you can also switch drugs or lower the dose. So if people are developing side effects, it's easy to back off on the dose. And eventually, if your insurance company will allow you, you can switch to the other medicine. But often they've been approved for different reasons, so that's often not as easy unless patients are paying out of pocket. But those are mostly GI side effects. And again, the dietary things we talked about, low calories, spread out through the day, no big meals, no added sugar, no fat, because fat prolongs time in the food in the stomach, can prevent the side effects.
A related question is, any thoughts about reported vision loss?
Yeah, well, that is something we're following with interest. That appears to be true. There are new reports on that recently, but it's rare. And so I think it's just something to pay attention to. And, these drugs have been used for a long time in diabetes in patients who are visually vulnerable. And we just haven't seen that much of that. So I think these are going to turn out to be rare side effects.
So where I'm at, it's very expensive to order the medications. Even if they're approved, it's cheaper to use a compounding pharmacy. But then last month, most of the compounding pharmacies disappeared because it's not, it's more accessible. So what do you do about cost? And then also, the compounding pharmacies are adding glycine to prevent muscle wasting. Is that, does that work?
So the FDA does not recommend compounded pharmacies. They were approved because there was a shortage. Now that the shortage has been resolved, they lost the ability to sell that with under that rationale. You know, I think the problem with compounded pharmacies is you don't know what you're getting. Now, it's hard to be categorical about that. I mean, obviously, there are some great compounded pharmacies and some great systems, but they are adding other substances to allow that compounding, to make it a compounded substance. You don't always know what they're adding, and you don't know the impact of what they're adding. There's no benefit of the one you mentioned. Particularly, but there's many other substances that people will add. I generally recommend people not to use a compounded pharmacy. I think, though, there are some big companies out there that are really getting their quality standards up, and it may be that the community will, you know, that pendulum will swing a little bit, but now that we have access to the medicines, that's what we recommend. The Lilly Direct option, like I said, is a half price, depending on the dose, and it gets it a little bit closer to where the compounded pharmacies were, and I think that's something to look into in your community. So it's about $400 a month. Yeah. Oh.
Last one, I think.
When I tell young people don't drink your calories, which I learned from you from previous years, I get kind of a roll of the eyes, this kind of glaze, and I don't think they hear it or listen. This is just so common. Do you have any other pearls or motivating things for younger, you know, adolescents, people in their 20s, in terms of drinking calories?
You know, soda taxes, that's worked in Mexico. No, you just have to, you know, don't, for parents, don't bring it into your home. Make sure that people understand that we're not just talking about soda pop, but fruit juices and fruit drinks. And, you know, even orange juice has a ton of calories. So, you know, healthy things can still. So I don't like blend, you know, I don't like people to drink a lot of calories as blended drinks. I'd rather they eat to make sure they're getting all the dietary fiber and not the simple sugars.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.